This fellow had been a friend of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, had moved down to Florida, was living in the Orlando area. And then last year, about a month, I guess it was maybe 2 months after the bombing, the FBI was in contact with this fellow. They interviewed him several times, FBI along with Boston State Troopers. And on one occasion, which ended up being the final occasion, they went to his apartment and they interviewed him. Now, he had told a friend that he was very uncomfortable with all this. He, according to the friend, said that he felt that he was about to be framed or that they were attempting to make him say something that was not true. He was very uncomfortable, and he even expressed doubts about whether he was going to get out of that alive, which is quite an astonishing statement, but it turned out, Guillermo, to have been very prescient. And indeed, before the night was over, Ibrahim Todashev was dead. The story of what happened to him is a murky one. There were a number of different versions that came out, but basically he was apparently shot by an FBI agent. There are different stories about how and why that shooting took place, which we can certainly get into. Mm-hmm. The upshot of it is that Todashev is dead. The FBI did not release the names of either the FBI agent who was there or two Boston State troopers who were present either in the room or nearby. And that was really the state of affairs until recently.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason that the FBI was interested in Todashev was not just his connection to Tamerlan in relation to the bombing itself, but he was supposedly also involved in that murder that took place back in September 2011 near Boston. So this is the weird case where the Tamerlan's friends, their throats were slit, their bodies were sprinkled with marijuana. Very, very strange case there. And I don't know if... I'll ask you this. Did the police or the FBI ever make a definitive link, ever present any sort of evidence that Todashev was indeed involved with that at all?
No, not to my knowledge. In fact, this is also very strange. The entire larger penumbra under which you can put the Boston bombing and some of these other situations has never been, let me put it this way. It has been the subject of a tremendous number of leaks from law enforcement to the media. And so what you've had is a situation where our perceptions have been shaped to the point where, without even any kind of trial or anything like that, we have a sense that we know what happened, that we know that these people did things. Now, what you're talking about was a triple homicide in the Boston suburb of Waltham,
right.
And it involved the deaths of three young men who knew Tamerlan Tsarnaev. At least a couple of them were said to be good friends of his. These fellows may have been, or apparently were, although I'm hesitant because all of this information needs to be verified,
exactly,
involved, let's say perhaps, with dealing in drugs. Of course, that a lot is made of that, but we know the large extent to which drugs are a part of the American economy, so I wouldn't wouldn't read too much into that in terms of the connecting people who sell drugs to a particular murder as being any kind of a normal component. Obviously, let me restate that. Obviously, there's a lot of violence associated with drug dealing, but it's not automatic at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most Americans who utilize recreational drugs buy them from people in a relatively peaceful environment of commerce. So the fact that there was a triple homicide in which these people were gruesomely murdered and their bodies covered, as I understand it, with marijuana and also with a large amount of cash was dumped on them. Obviously, some statement attempting to be made, and whoever did it knew that when the press got a hold of that story, they would make much of that. It would be a much more dramatic news story than otherwise. Now,
right.
that then right away raises the question as to, you know, it's one thing to kill somebody, it's somebody else, something else to kill someone in such a spectacular way and to be so dramatic and attention-seeking. And so a lot of these things are very, very strange questions that, you know, were there really any indications that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was capable of something like that, that he would have done that, they would have done that to his friend. And so this is all a strange, strange story. But that story, that that case, which was from several years before the Boston Marathon bombing, was never solved. And yet the news leaks indicate that law enforcement supposedly had evidence that Tamerlan Tsarnaev's mobile phone may have been in the vicinity at the time, which of course raises the question, if they knew that back then, why did they not do anything about it?
Exactly.
And especially since we are told that law enforcement has such a high rate of success in solving homicides. So it's a very, very strange case. And then you have this Todashev, this friend of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's, who the sense of him and the reason he may be important is because he would have been one of the best able to provide an assessment of the older brother and I suppose of the younger brother and of their relationship and of whether they were the sorts of people who, A, would have been inclined to do something like the Boston Marathon bombing, and B, would have had the capability and the knowledge to rig up a reasonably complicated incendiary device and all of that. And third of all, whether they would have acted the way they did, which was they went back to their lives just as if nothing had happened up until the point at which they had the altercation with law enforcement some days later. So, you know, he would have been a natural person to call, I assume, onto the stand for the defense of the younger brother who was going to stand trial. And, of course, with him out of the way and some of the other people out of the way, there are fewer and fewer available defense witnesses. Now, that's very important. And I'll say one more thing, and that is a new development that's just happened, and that is that a young taxi driver who also was a friend of the Tsarnaev brothers has just been arrested in charge with obstruction and some other things. And the question again is, why now? Why so late? Well, I mean, one thing that is just a fact is that he's yet another one of these potential defense witnesses that at least is being compromised, if not entirely removed from the equation. So that's the that's the sort of larger background to this thing. Now, as far as this Todashev goes, at the scene where he was killed in Orlando by the FBI agent, the law enforcement claims that he had just signed a confession in the Waltham triple homicide that he, along with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, were involved in killing these three people, that he confessed to that and then moments later inexplicably attacked the officers and then was gunned down. So, you know, just empirically speaking, I think any fair-minded person would look at all of this and say,
Exactly. No, you know, I guess you'll have to forgive my cynicism, I suppose, because to me, all of this, the killing of Ibrahim Todashev, now you mentioned this young taxi driver being picked up, the killing of Tamerlan Tsarnaev during the chase, the attempted killing of Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, to me, this all amounts to what seems to be tying up loose ends. That's just me, but, you know, that's what it seems like. We should get into the specifics of the Ibrahim Todashev case, because, as you mentioned, there are some new developments in the naming of this FBI agent. But for folks to understand why this is important, why it's important that, first of all, the FBI attempted to keep this from the public, and then it's important that we now have it. But it's important within the context that the details of the case are so very, very murky, differing accounts. If memory serves, the statements, the official government narrative was that, you know, they were all in the room. Then it turned out, no, they had left the room. The state troopers had left the room. Only the FBI agent was in the room. They initially said Todashev was armed. He had a sword, I think I heard at one point. Then it turned into a knife. Then it turned into a broom handle. So there were so many differing accounts. And you made an excellent point earlier that all of this has been shaped by official leaks from the police and from the government. That's how this public narrative has been shaped. And boy, doesn't that sound familiar.
You know, yeah, I mean, one of the basic problems is that we all grew up on the notion of innocent until proven guilty, mm-hmm. that the justice system in the United States bends over backwards to protect the rights of everyone, and that the onus is on the prosecutors to prove that somebody did something. And yet, in this case, very clearly, they are hanging these people in the court of public opinion. That itself is very, very troubling. I'm sure all of us would want, if we were ever accused, to have the benefit of the doubt. And, you know, the fact that the government doesn't seem to be troubled by this, the fact that, Attorney General has not spoken out against it, the President has not spoken out against it, Democratic senators with so-called civil libertarian credentials have not spoken out against it, against this. They raise questions about a larger concern, which is, what is really happening in this country? Is this country changing in some fundamental way since the introduction of Homeland Security as a concept? And are we actually not losing all kinds of rights?
Indeed. No, excellent point. I completely agree with that. In fact, I do think that's exactly what is happening. You know, so let's get into this new story, as I mentioned. There's an article out now on whowhatwhy.com by Christian Stork, Todashev's killer, no wonder his identity was secret. And this article references a post on the Boston Marathon bombings blog that first uncovered the name of the FBI agent who shot and killed Todashev via an improperly redacted PDF. And so it also references a report by the Boston Globe that dug into the past of this agent. His name is Aaron McFarlane, aged 41. So just to be clear, it appears that the FBI did want his name kept from the press, but now we have it. And so, Russ, tell us about this Aaron McFarlane person and the other officers in the room or near the room, Massachusetts State Troopers Curtis Sinelli and Joel Gagne. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But why all this secrecy to begin with? Why do you make of that?
Well, you see, the problem is that the FBI feels that it should not be subject to the same standards as everybody else. It basically, under J. Edgar Hoover for half a century, did anything it wanted, much of it illegal. And this is well documented in hearings and trials and books and what have you. But the really shocking thing is that after J. Edgar Hoover died, nothing changed. And the FBI continued to operate with impunity. It sets whatever rules it wants. And so, for example, there's a long track record of FBI agents going to visit Americans and telling them to shut their mouths. Hmm. Now, I have asked many people, the constitutional experts and lawmakers and people in law enforcement, do they have any legal right to tell somebody not to talk about something? And the answer invariably is no. And yet they do that. And so that's illegal. That's the first thing. The second thing is all law enforcement agencies, as far as I know, now tape confessions, all except the FBI, which has a policy of not taping confessions. And not only do they do that without anybody, as far as I know, in the government, including, again, people like Obama and so forth, you know, they don't seem to say anything about this or to be bothered by this. The FBI, instead, what they do, they say, well, they have reasons they don't want to tape it. They had given various reasons. I think they felt that it would somehow inhibit the process. Mm-hmm. But instead, what they say is that's why we have two agents always present, so that one takes notes and can sign the statement while the other conducts the interrogation. Now, that, as I understand it, is standard operating procedure for the FBI, and yet in the case of Todashev, there was only one FBI agent in the room, and so that's very, very problematical. Now, because the FBI doesn't tape, we understand that the Boston State Troopers tape recorded for their own purposes, apparently over the objections of the FBI agent. It would be very, very interesting, of course, to get one's hands on that tape, if it in fact exists. I have a feeling that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't bet on that. So this again, McFarland though is interesting because as the article here by Stork references in that report by the Boston Globe, he has quite the shady history. So first of all, why an agent like this, McFarland, would have been allowed to join the FBI to begin with, given his history. But it's even more interesting to me, and I'd like your opinion on this, why someone like this would be allowed anywhere near such an important witness in what the government calls the biggest terrorist act in American soil since 9/11. I mean, this is a massively important case with massively important implications. And here we have a man with connections to Tamerlan, with a critical piece of the puzzle to finding the truth. And who gets the assignment to go down to Florida and interview him but an ex-cop with a shady history, suspected of corruption, prone to violence, and not even 100% there physically, formerly on disability pension? That's who they send. So, you know, I guess this could be easily dismissed as incompetence, I suppose. But to me, I mean, this guy McFarland strikes me as the perfect kind of fall guy. I wanted to get your impression of that.
Yeah. Again, just the background on that, as you mentioned, Guillermo, the names came out by improper redaction of some documents. Now, unfortunately, of course, I say unfortunately because our preferences at whowhatwhy.com are for disclosure and public awareness, and our preference is for that over the protection of information that we think is in the public interest that it be revealed. We're skeptical of the need to protect most of the information that law enforcement and the government seeks to protect. And we're concerned that because of this, all the publicity about the improper redaction, that what we're going to see now is no more improper redactions. And therefore, we will go back to never knowing the names in any of these cases. But in any case, here, a mistake was made. It actually was a blog run by, let's call them amateur researchers who used a common software to unredact this thing. And then the Boston Globe picked it up. And they did some more research on who this person was, who these people were at the scene of the shooting of Mr. Todeshev. Now, the key figure, the FBI agent that you mentioned, he had some years earlier worked for the Oakland, California Police Department, and I think it's important to mention, and we may be doing some more work on all of these issues, is that the Oakland, California Police are not just a police department. They are one that is so famously corrupt that the department was actually taken over by a federal master, that is the city's police department overseen by the feds because they didn't trust anymore the department or the city to run itself. With so much corruption, so much brutality, so much really just the kind of scenes right out of, you know, whatever it's called, the bad policeman. And McFarland was one of these people. And, you know, they have this thing called the blue wall of silence where police officers almost never testify against each other and essentially often lie on the stand in order to clear their colleagues. This is almost an unwritten standard that you must do this or you're out. So there is some sense that McFarland may have done that. There certainly were allegations to that effect. And he also was accused of brutality, and there was a situation of planting evidence on suspects. And so now you say, well, my God, I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That is a lot. Lying on the stand, tolerating corruption, prone to violence, you know, falsifying evidence and basically framing people, you know, and so, yeah, so it's very, very interesting that this man worked even as a police officer. He leaves the department not because he had done those things, but because he was at a disability, supposedly. And then, of course, with a disability, you would think then he gets a pension now.
Right.
And you would think then he would be retired and having some trouble moving around. Instead, he gets hired by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They apparently either had no trouble with his past, which they clearly knew about, or rather perhaps liked it. They had no trouble with his disability or perhaps liked it. And so he then joins the FBI, and as you point out so ably, he ends up not only working for the FBI, but working in this incredibly sensitive case of the second largest terror attack in United States history with a witness who may hold absolutely crucial evidence, and he kills him. And I would have to agree with you. I think any fair-minded person would look at this and would say, there is something really, really wrong with this. And when you look at the totality of the case and you read the probably several dozen articles that we've done on whowhatwhy.com about the Boston Marathon bombing, and you see all of these kinds of things, one after another, after another, after another, you say, just statistically, numerologically, it almost seems impossible to consider all of these things and conclude that this is just the straight and narrow, that this is just what the government is telling us and no more.
Exactly. And that's an excellent point, Russ. I'm really glad that you brought that up just now, because that's important for the audience to understand. Anyone who's coming at this for the first time might be saying to themselves, well, you know, okay, this guy, this police officer sounds a little shady, but so what? I suppose in and of itself, it may not be enough to doubt the entirety of the official government account of the Boston Marathon bombing, but as you just mentioned, in within the context of so many other things, so many other aspects of this story that do not add up, When you add this to it, it really does raise so many different red flags. As you say, to any fair-minded person, anyone looking at this objectively with an open mind, who doesn't just, you know, swallow whatever government propaganda is being fed to them, I think would have to question at this point what exactly happened last April in Boston at the marathon. It's so many different things. I mean, we talked a little bit last time about the intelligence world, I should say, I guess, in a way, the CIA specifically, connections to the Tsarnaev family. Uncle Ruslan is a very interesting character. You mentioned earlier how so many people who were sympathetic, I suppose, to the Tsarnaev brothers, who in some way may have said they did not believe the government's account, how they're being either taken out or whisked away or deported or something. Someone who was absolutely not deported, but on the contrary, became quite the media darling in the subsequent days of the bombing, was this Uncle Ruslan character, Ruslan Tsarny, formerly Ruslan Tsarnaev, who immediately came out. I think it was either the day that the names were announced or the day after. It was very, very quickly. He came out and said, yep, they did it. they would do something like that. Absolutely. Yep, they did it. And the fact that this man has so many connections to, he worked for USAID. He's worked for Halliburton at various points in his life. He's been associated with the CIA. He married the daughter of Graham Fuller, who was a high-level CIA operative. I mean, I can't look at that and just say that's a coincidence.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think the larger thing to keep in mind here is that we're not hearing the kinds of things that you and I are talking about being discussed in the American media. We're not hearing it being discussed in the halls of government, at least not publicly. We're not hearing it being discussed among Americans. And so while something very chilling is going on in this country, it is going on almost undetected. It is a very small number of people who are engaged, whether it's listening to your podcast, coming to our site, whowhatwhy.com, online, discussing this on discussion boards and so on. Although there certainly are thousands of people who are well informed on this and care, thousands out of a country with hundreds of millions is a very, very small percentage. And for anyone who lived in a country that basically turned repressive and then authoritarian and then in many cases totalitarian, they've seen this kind of pattern before, and they understand how incredibly dangerous it is that this sort of an issue in this kind of a situation is not even part of the public awareness, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I mean, I do think there's more and more, and I'm hopeful in that regard that there are more and more, not just media outlets providing this information, but just people in general with a hunger for this type of information, for asking serious questions asking serious questions about serious events in our recent history or history period. There's more of it, and so I'm hopeful that that there will be even more. And I wanted to bring up one last quick point to you, sort of in closing. I may have even mentioned this to you last time we talked, but I'll go ahead and mention it again just in case, because I want to emphasize what I think is a very important point in all of this, within this, the context of the Ibrahim Todashev case, and that is the issue of these quote-unquote targeted killings that have been talked about in the press. Usually within the context of, you know, the extrajudicial killings that occur overseas via drone strikes in places like Somalia and Yemen and Pakistan, etc. And for a time, not that long ago, the issue was really dominating the media cycle. It was being debated in Washington within the context of John Brennan's nomination as director of the CIA. And to some extent, the issue is still being talked about, although not nearly enough, I think. I think there are still far too few people who know the names Anwar al-Awlaki or his 16-year-old son, Abdul Rahman, or the other two American citizens who the Obama administration killed without trial, without ever presenting a shred of evidence. After that, the debate began, you know, could this happen on American soil? Would the government ever consider killing an American citizen within its own borders without a trial, without evidence, doing so entirely in secret? And I felt very much alone within this debate, finding it quite silly. I mean, in a way, I was glad that the issue was being raised and talked about, but I think it was being completely mischaracterized. We had, you know, political, who I consider political opportunists like Rand Paul and others being praised for filibustering the Senate, demanding that the Obama administration come out and say they would never drone kill an American within the United States. And I think that just completely misses the point on so many different levels. First of all, the government shouldn't be killing anybody, American citizen or not. But secondly, and this is the point that brings me to the Ibrahim Todashev case, if the government wanted to kill someone, let's say, they're not going to do it with a drone, right? The U.S. government has executed extrajudicial killings of undesirable people, politically undesirable or otherwise, forever. And they have. There's so many different examples of this. I don't even have the time to list them all. But if you'd like a quick one, for those of you listening, just Google the name Fred Hampton, and that'll bring you up to speed. So if they were to take someone out, a drone would be the last thing they would use. The go-to move is usually either the FBI or local police. A SWAT team, a raid, a suspect believed to be armed. Oops, turned out he wasn't. Now he's dead. Happens all the time. So, Russ, I'd like, you know, I know you'd rather not speculate too much on this, but what does your gut tell you about this Todashev case? Does it look like an interrogation gone wrong to you and then a subsequent cover-up, or does it look like a hit?
Well, you know, of course, one can't know for sure. The particulars of what they leaked and their explanations to me don't add up. The claims that he attacked them, that he would sign a confession, then attack them. They did not properly note that this fellow, although he was a mixed martial arts expert, that he had recently had knee surgery, that's quite serious in limiting a person's ability to engage in martial arts. You know, these things are very, very troubling. And although, you know, I don't want to speculate as to what happened, I would say that there are enough particulars and enough anomalies that I think that a fair-minded grand jury would be inclined to move forward to explore whether this was, in fact, a homicide. And a deliberate one at that.
I agree. I think so too. Again, that we didn't get into too much of the physical evidence, but there have been some anomalies with the official story. I think I've heard reports or seen reports rather about the fatal shot coming from behind Todashev in the back of the head. I haven't seen any sort of definitive proof in that regard, but I think you're right. At the very least, a grand jury would indict this as a homicide or look into it and should look into it, because that would answer some questions for us, I think. Whether if this was to be ruled a homicide, boy, would that open up a can of worms in this case. And I think that would force many people out there who have not yet begun to think about this or even question what exactly happened. I think that would really move that along, and the truth would eventually come out. Russ, I think we should leave it there, but I do want to have you just please let the audience here know just any parting thoughts on the Todashev case specifically, the Boston Marathon bombing generally, or anything at all for that matter. Just your parting thoughts, and then of course, please mention to folks where they can check out your work with Who, What, Why.
First of all, I understand that for most of us, there are a lot of names here. Mm-hmm. And it's work to keep them straight. It's work to memorize them, to figure out who's who and what all the particulars are. Most of us are too busy and have too many distractions to want or be able to do that. And I understand that it's easy to sort of think of this as kind of an exotic matter that is purely optional, but I would just advise and beseech, I would say, folks not to take that approach, because I don't think that things like this can be viewed in isolation. I think they need to be seen as part of a larger pattern of events that are showing us where our country is and where our country is going. I think it's there are indications of some real substantial and spreading darkness over American democracy. And I think that it's just too serious and too grave to be ignored. And I do hope that everyone will find the time to become well-informed on this topic and will make an effort to bring it to the attention of others, both those who purportedly are in a position to do something, that would be particularly members of Congress, for example, but also just your friends and people you know. Get people talking about this stuff. I just can't think of anything more important than all of us being vigilant about developments that may bode ill for our own democracy.
Now, we conclude with perhaps the founder of Deep State Research, Peter Dale Scott, introducing his latest book, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. This is from November 2014, and it was first broadcast on TUC Radio by Maria Geladin, who also recorded it. Many thanks to her.
I want to begin by thanking you all for coming, and I want to thank City Lights, and above all Peter, who's been my host, three times now, for this event. I'm going to start with this book and its cover. Those of you who have seen the cover, has anyone identified the big plane that I put on top of the White House? This is not an actual photograph. It's a composite of two photographs. This is not Air Force One, as a lot of people guess. It's an E-4B. And do I have to explain, as I suspect I do? It's also called the Doomsday Plane. It is the plane which was worked out as part of the Doomsday Project I'm going to talk about tonight, continuity of government planning, COG planning. I do, in fact, call it change of government planning because it was implemented on 9/11, and because of the implementation, we have seen some very real changes. And on that day, at about 10 o'clock, CNN captured a video which I give you a URL for. It's the first prose.
And we don't have time for the whole video, but just to give you a snippet of what Peter Dale Scott is talking about, I hit YouTube and found the following clip.
Today, 6 years after 9/11, the mystery endures about just what happened in the skies over the White House that terrible day. A plane flew right over it. But why? And what was it? For conspiracy theorists, the image is a gold mine. It appeared overhead just before 10 a.m., a four-engine jet banking slowly in the nation's most off-limits airspace on the White House ground and the rooftop in nervous scramble.
About 10 minutes ago, there was a white jet circling overhead.
And still today, no one will offer an official explanation of what we saw. Two government sources familiar with the incident tell CNN it was a military aircraft. Say the details are classified. This comparison of the CNN video and an official Air Force photo suggests the mystery plane is among the military's most sensitive aircraft, an Air Force E-4B. Perhaps the Pentagon, and it insists this is not a military aircraft, and there is no mention of it in the official report of the 9/11 Commission. Commission co-chairman Lee Hamilton says he has a vague recollection of someone mentioning a mystery plane. The staffers who looked into it never raised it as a relevant issue. To some, the lack of any official explanation feeds an ominous conspiracy. This is from an online discussion about the plane on the website 911blogger.com. I have always thought these planes were exactly that, mission control for the 9/11 attack on our country. But 6 years later, the Pentagon, the Secret Service, and the FAA all say they, at least for public consumption, have no explanation of the giant plane over the president's house, just as the smoke began to rise across the river.
And explain, that's why there was this sudden exit from the White House, because there was a plane overhead. You may know that that's forbidden airspace. No plane is ever supposed to be there. The E-4B, which is for the use of the president. It's for national command authority, the president, the secretary of defense. The president, of course, was in Tampa, and the secretary of defense at about this time was helping put people on stretchers outside the Pentagon building, which seems an odd thing to do when your nation is under attack, but that's what he apparently did. So why was that plane there? We don't know. Why did CNN take the news clip off their website? Luckily, somebody had captured it, and it's back up from somewhere else. But it's apparently something we're not supposed to know about. And that's why we really have two kinds of history in this country. We have history that is in the newspapers and in the books of people who do archival research, some of them very good books, but there are some events which are either never in the newspapers and media or withdrawn from the media once they're in. And to poke around with those data, which I think you have to do, gets you from one point of view into what I call deep history, and that's what this book is about. Or, if you don't like people doing this, you say that's conspiracy theory. Well, it's been a long time since my last book, 5 years, and I actually had a manuscript already at the beginning of 2011, which is, I think, the date in my contract. I was beginning with an essay about continuity of government, COG. I gave a talk at the Commonwealth Club. I see at least one face in the audience who was there, I think. And it's very serious to me that Ronald Reagan in 1982 set up a committee to plan for, or to deal with existing plans, quite legitimate plans at the beginning, to deal with an atomic attack. What do you do if the nation is decapitated? You lose the president and the vice president and the Speaker of the House. How are you going to handle the succession? So you have to do something beyond what the Constitution is talking about. But they created a committee, and it had people in the government and people not in the government. And by the late 1990s, when Clinton was president, two people who had been on it from the very beginning, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, neither of them were in the government. And yet they were planning for what one journalist, Chardy, called suspension of the Constitution, which is about right. They were planning for suspension of the Constitution even though they had no governmental status except being on a secret committee that had been appointed by a president no longer in power. And Oliver North was working on this at the time of Iran-Contra, and he was actually asked about it in the Iran-Contra hearings. Is it true you're planning for suspension of the Constitution. And he never gave an answer because the chairman of the Senate committee, who was a Democrat, banged his gavel and said we would have to go into that in an executive session, more or less confirming that, yes, that is what he was doing. And it's also secret. We don't know whether there ever was an executive session or not. There are books that say that Congress really didn't know what was happening, even though the plans included the massive evacuation of Congress to these hollowed-out mountains around Washington. So it was very high secret stuff. And it became clear, even before Iran-Contra, that it was now being used with other ends in view, and particularly one which caught the eye of journalists then, massive detentions, warrantless detentions. In fact, there were three elements that were described by more than one journalist. The first one was warrantless surveillance. We all know about that now from Edward Snowden. The second was warrantless detention. And the third one was called back then martial law. Well, in a sense, all three were implemented on 9/11, except you have to qualify about martial law. They did not technically get martial law, but we have definitely seen, and it's been on our TV cameras recently, the militarization of homeland security. In many ways, what you see are these really armed personnel carriers and very heavy duty military equipment given to police forces. I think much more important is the fact that in 2002 they created an army command for continental United States, so that just as they have a command for South America, Southcom, now there's one for Northcom. And do you all know that we have been in a state of emergency ever since September? Two states of emergency, actually, since September 14th, 2011. There is a law passed after Watergate, one of the Church Committee reforms. It says that Congress shall review any declaration of a state of emergency and either affirm it or let it lapse. It's supposed to do that in 6 months. Well, we've gone now for 13 years, and it still hasn't happened. And when a former congressman and I tried to mobilize some public opinion to get it to happen, one of the congressmen told a constituent that that law isn't in effect anymore because of COG. And if that's true, this is a single hearsay statement. I can't verify if it's true or not, but if it's true, that would certainly mean that, in effect, the Constitution has been suspended. So how could this happen? When I started to write this book, I had written first about a deep state back in 2007 and then again in 2010, but I was almost apologetic about using it because the term deep state comes from Turkey and there refers to an organized parallel government set up, I think, with CIA encouragement 30 or 40 years ago, involving gangs of killers. And you have that in Turkey. You had something like that in Colombia. You could argue by extension that you had something like that in Italy. I don't think we have something like that in America. And so maybe I'll begin with somebody else's definition of, well, a couple of definitions. In the Washington Post not long ago, Dana Priest and William Arkin said, and this is a quote, two governments, the one its citizens were familiar with, operated more or less in the open, the other a parallel top-secret government whose parts had mushroomed in less than a decade, in other words, since 2001, into a gigantic, sprawling universe of its own, visible only to a carefully vetted cadre. Now, there was a man called Mike Lofgren who was on the Bill Moyer show at the beginning of this year, and he used the term deep state for America. And he added to that notion, if we start peeling the onion, and behind the level of the public state, you see agencies like the NSA and the CIA, which is, maybe I'll have time to explain, really are very, very marginally controlled by Congress. They have, particularly the CIA, access to their own funds. So the budgetary control does not exist for them. And yet you have another level, what I call the private intelligence corporations, Booz Allen Hamilton, which I talk about in the book, SAIC, which I talked more about in The American War Machine. These private corporations get most of the intelligence budget now, something like 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget, which is like $60 million a year, we're talking big money, is outsourced to private corporations, and they have links not just to the Pentagon and to the CIA and to NSA, but they also have links to big U.S. corporations. And in fact, Booz Allen, its history was working for the largest U.S. corporations, first at home and then since 1953 abroad. Very interestingly, that they went abroad to exactly the countries that the CIA in 53, Dulles has just become the director. It started mounting extensive operations in the Philippines, in Egypt, and in Iran, and that is exactly where Booz Allen also went. And I trace one, I think, important individual, Miles Copeland, who started by working for the CIA, and then he shifted over doing the same thing, doing it for Booz Allen Hamilton, but now, of course, completely beyond congressional control, and then finally ended up as the senior aide to a man called Adnan Khashoggi, who was making millions and millions of dollars in percentages of defense contracts with Saudi Arabia, which were then used to subsidize projects which before then had been subsidized by the CIA. This is all very important. That level is important not just because they get so much of the U.S. intelligence budget, but because they blend into a world of corporations and banks and above all, oil. Booz Allen definitely had big contracts with what I call big oil, the old Seven Sisters, as they were back in the 50s. So you have the level of the CIA, NSA, the level of these outsourced corporations, and finally, where I think you really have to look for the ultimate seat of power, the corporations that financed firms like Booz Allen before the CIA financed them. And I think we can point specifically to Wall Street and to Big Oil. Big Oil was very centered in New York in the 1950s. It was operating as a cartel. Truman and his Justice Department were threatening to break up the cartel. They demanded to see certain documents, and the oil companies said, unfortunately, we can't produce these documents that would betray national security secrets. And they sort of delayed and delayed and delayed until you had the 1952 elections, in which Eisenhower, very much supported by Big Oil, won the election, and he put into, as Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and as Director of CIA, Allen Dulles, from the law firm Sullivan and Cromwell that had been fighting on behalf of the oil cartel and managed to get there were criminal charges against the cartel which were dropped. And the oil companies have since continued to operate as a cartel. They can manipulate oil prices. I think, frankly, we're seeing manipulated oil prices now as we're trying to punish Putin for what's happening in Eastern Europe. Certainly, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you saw manipulated oil prices in the 1980s. When they were trying to bring down the Soviet Union, because Gorbachev had planned all these big reforms for Russia, and he suddenly had no budget to do it because the price of oil dropped to, what was it, $16 a barrel or something like that? And then, of course, went back up again. These are not market-determined operations. These are covert operations in which the CIA, I've read an interview with a senior CIA officer who boasted about the CIA role in that. CIA, the oil companies, and I'll have to say more about this, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has become a kind of working partner of big oil because they are the major linchpin of OPEC. Well, I could say much more about that. Let me give you an example of what I think proves that the CIA isn't just working for the U.S. government. It is working for the deep state and the and for Wall Street. And let me, even before that, give a quotation from Franklin Roosevelt in 1933, wrote to his friend Colonel House in a private letter. And he said, "You and I know that financial interests in certain major centers have controlled this government since the age of Jackson." So that is a very deep historical perspective for the existence of what I call the deep state. I would actually take it back to the American Revolution. There's a very interesting new book just come out called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Has anyone heard of it? And it offers it a major reason why the wealthy interests of America wanted independence very rapidly was because England was about to emancipate slaves. And they were going to do it not just for England, but for the colonies. They did do it for the colonies. And if the Americas had still been a colonies, well, then South Carolina, for example, which was 60% black, and had a pretty steady, continuous history of slave uprisings, would have been faced with a very serious problem. So that's why this book says it was a counter-revolution. My view of the American Revolution is much more complicated. I think it achieved some things which were radically new for history, but they also preserved an institution which was artificially prolonged in America when it was being abolished in the rest of the world. So, yes, I think there's always been a deep state, but something has definitely happened, as the other Peter said, since World War II, and particularly since the death of Kennedy in the Vietnam War. And another event, I won't have time, I think, in my speech, but the Reagan Revolution really was a revolution. Roger Morris called it a coup. It saved the CIA from the kind of congressional scrutiny that was developing in the Carter administration with Senator Church. You know, we're still seeing that debate today, even. The release of the torture report is another attempt by Congress to assert its priority over the CIA. According to the Constitution, Congress is more a part of the ruling structure of the country than the CIA. The last time Congress did something like that, it produced the Reagan Revolution or counter-revolution, and I expect to see some kind of response to this quite radical step that has just been taken by releasing the torture report. So the Reagan Revolution changed things and set in motion this set of secret plans with a budget. There was something like $7 or $8 billion a year was being put into continuity of government planning. They created a separate network. And that's how Ollie North was able to get arms to Iran without the State Department knowing about it. He used the network that had been set up for continuity of government and used it to send arms to Iran. In my book, I suggest that what I call the major deep events, starting with the Kennedy assassination and including Watergate, I throw in what they call the October surprise, the planning to get rid of Carter in 1980 by delaying the return of the hostages that had been taken in the Tehran embassy. That's the October surprise. Certainly Iran-Contra, they all used this secret network. And on 9/11, it was officially implemented. And that, by the way, is, I think, why on that day, if you remember it, President Bush spent most of the day not in Washington because the vice president was there. That's part of the COG plans, that they not be in the same place. And then when Bush came back about 3:30 in the afternoon, Vice President Cheney immediately left and went off and lived in a hollowed-out mountain, one of the site R, or one of those structures, for about 90 days with a staff of 100. What were they doing? I think they were putting the finishing touches on the Patriot Act, and who knows what else they were doing. I've mentioned Operation Endgame. There was a plan for the emergency warrantless detention of numbers of people, large numbers of people, and that was implemented in 9/11. Everyone's upset about the warrantless surveillance because it affects all of us. But I personally, as a Canadian, I feel I've been surveilled for quite some time by this government. They're very polite about it. It hasn't upset me. But the warrantless detention is something else. There were about 1,000 Muslims. We don't even know how many. But more than 1,000 Muslims rounded up right after 9/11. No warrant, no explanation. I don't want to say that they were tortured, but I did meet one of them who was an academic, and he wasn't even an Arab. He was a Shia Muslim from Iran, but they rounded him up too, and they beat him so severely that there was blood in his urine, and they held him for 80 days, and then said, okay, go away, don't talk about this. I don't like analogies with Nazi Germany, but I do feel this one. All this happened to Muslims, and the rest of us don't seem to care. And I think we should care, because if they can do that to 1,000 Muslims, they can do it to anybody. And finally, because we're in a state of emergency, there is a brigade now, a U.S. Army brigade. I don't want to say permanently stationed. It's to deal with the emergency, but they went there in 2008, and they're still there to deal with any form of civil unrest that local police cannot control. So you may never see anti-war riots of the kind that you saw back in the 1960s. They have been planning rigorously to make sure they never happen again because, as Oliver North said in his testimony, he pointed his finger at one of the congressmen and said, you and I know that the war in Vietnam wasn't lost in Vietnam. It was lost right here in the streets of Washington. Those people believe that. Those people have planned to make sure it'll never happen again. And because I believe that a healthy democracy needs forces for change, you can't just stick with what you have. It becomes more and more corrupt. And we have been in a kind of sticking with what we have for far too long. I have hopes for America. They're not unqualified hopes. I'm not quite sure what should happen. So I don't end my book with prose. I end it with a poem in praise of Mario Savio and the free speech movement because Mario Savio represented a very strong American tradition and with Martin Luther King and, of course, Henry Thoreau. And we need that American tradition. And it has a practice of turning up when you most need it. And I hope it will turn up again. And now I think I definitely better stop and take some questions.
And if you'd like to hear the lively Q&A session, that was also broadcast on TUC Radio, and I shall link it in from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/712. This and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. I recently put out a request on the mailing list for volunteers to read short excerpts, a few sentences at most. Thank you to everyone who's volunteered. I'm still looking for more volunteers, so if you'd like to help produce the next episode on Gladio, you can do so by emailing me, unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. You need to speak English, but you don't need to be a native speaker. Our theme tune, The Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. And the prophet says, yeah.